From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan is demanding answers from Facebook about the company's business practices.
People need to know. All that information that you put out there is collected by them, and it's used by them, it's sold by them.
30,000 people were expected for a rally and march.
This morning, tens of thousands of people packed Union Park shouting out their frustrations with lawmakers over gun control and school safety.
You're supposed to like learn in school, not be scared that you're gonna get shot.
We're here because the students and the young people are telling our generation it's time to get it right.
House Speaker Mike Madigan's political fund face a first ever sexual harassment lawsuit.
Elena Hampton contends that if she had not complained about being sexually harassed by a high-ranking lieutenant of Mike Madigan's, she would still be working in campaigns that Madigan was supporting.
A number of people knew about the harassment while it was happening, and a lot of them responded with, "It happens. You know, it's, you just have to live with it."
Madigan's spokesman responded today saying, quote, "I can assure you that the Democratic Party of Illinois and the friends of Michael J. Madigan have not retaliated against Ms. Hampton in any way."
Elena Hampton, she's the woman who has alleged sexual harassment while being a campaign worker. She's now suing the state Democratic Party chair, Michael Madigan, and the organization he runs. Also, Lisa Madigan targeting Facebook. And after a weekend full of marches against gun violence, state lawmakers held another hearing on the topic. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He runs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And from our Statehouse Bureau, joining us via Skype, we have Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio's Statehouse reporter, and Dave Dahl from WTAX. Dave, thanks for being with us once again.
Hello, thank you.
All right, I'm going to start with the Elena Hampton issue that came up this week. She's been in the news before, creating some headlines when she talked about those harassment allegations and claimed that the Speaker of the House and State Democratic Party Chair Michael Madigan dragged his feet on taking action. Now she's taking this matter to court. Brian, what's the reasoning there?
Her reasoning basically is that she says she was retaliated against for making this complaint, that she says she became persona non grata in the sort of top Democratic political circles in which Speaker Madigan travels or keeps tabs on for making this complaint. The House Speaker put out a statement, as you would expect, saying there was no retaliation. But, you know, this lawsuit opens the possibility that there's going to be depositions and subpoenas of documents. And the lawyers for Ms. Hampton say they're going to be looking for, you know, text messages, emails, anything that they can find to figure out, you know, exactly what was said and when about how this complaint was handled.
And Dave, this just adds to the pressure, doesn't it, that's going on House Speaker and State Democratic Party Chair Michael Madigan, not just on this issue, but others. This just adds to that.
Well, you say pressure. I'm not sure what's in the Speaker's head. He may not feel it. But it's certainly another voice, a louder voice, and the specter of all the things you mentioned, of more stuff getting out into the public that they're not going to want into the public. So it's certainly not an up day for the Speaker / party chair.
Charlie, we don't have too many of these types of cases that have at least come forward the way this one has. And most of what we see in Illinois when somebody's being sued or some alleged wrongdoing, it tends to be over things like corruption, graft, possibly. This is just not something we see that often in Illinois.
No, it's kind of unusual, but we're in entirely different times, and the kind of behavior that back in the day when I was an active reporter, you know, many, many years ago, this stuff occurred. And the attitude was, as Ms. Hampton suggested, well, it happens. There was not this awareness of what a toxic atmosphere it can be for women when you are working with a bunch of people, males who have kind of this fraternity brother attitude that women are there for their use. And so it's, as I say, it's like a new age, and people are having to be more sensitive to stuff that they do that they think doesn't mean anything, but women would find very offensive. And I suspect that Ms. Hampton's suit won't be the first one that's coming forward. And I'm guessing that when all is said and done, it won't just be the House Democratic operation that's involved. I think you're likely to see the same kind of complaints against Senate Democrats, House Republicans, Senate Republicans, the administration, because in my experience, this kind of boorish behavior was not limited to one party or one legislative chamber.
Brian, I think it's important to point out here, too, this is a suit that's been filed in federal court, not state court here in Illinois. Does that mean that this could be resolved faster, or is it going to take longer?
You know, I guess that just depends on how the parties deal with it. We've seen some federal cases drag on forever and ever. You know, you might remember a certain Illinois congressman named Aaron Schock. Now, that's a criminal matter, but that one's been going on for, what, a few years before it's going to get to trial. So I wouldn't look necessarily for a quick resolution of this case. But, you know, it's one of these things where we just have to say time will tell.
Yeah, I think to go back to Charlie's point, you are definitely not seeing any of the Republicans piling on the speaker because, well, glass houses.
And we should point out the lawsuit does name the state party chair being Michael Madigan in that capacity. At the same time, he has not been accused of any type of harassment, at least anything we're aware of that we know of at this point. But this is basically over whether or not he took the proper action and whether or not there was any type of, as we said, attempts at some type of retaliation on this case, correct?
It's what happens when you have somebody who is in charge. He doesn't have to do anything, but the buck stops with him and his organization, and maybe other people who are at the heads of their organizations can take note of that.
Yeah, and you're right, Sean, to point out that this is not an instance where he himself has been accused that we know of any, you know, personally having done any of this harassing behavior. This is a question of how he how his organization that he runs handled these complaints, you know, and these are some of the questions that Ms. Hampton and I think those of us on the outside want answered. You know, the speaker famously does not use cell phones. One imagines that he insulates himself from these sort of day-to-day concerns. But there is a question, you know, would this sort of thing have happened? You know, his top aide was ultimately, or one of his top aides was ultimately fired. You have to imagine that he had a hand in that decision. How much did he know leading up to that? What did he know? When did he know it, to use the old journalism cliche? And those are questions, I think, that you know, people will be trying to answer during the course of this lawsuit.
I think Dave mentioned an interesting – go ahead, Charlie.
Okay. I was going to say the point would be more, why did he take so long to fire these people for this type of boorish behavior? Now, historically, Michael Madigan has not been somebody who would jump to conclusions. He's not been someone who would act rashly or quickly. He would take his time thinking stuff over. And maybe this is an instance where that modus operandi failed him. He should have acted more quickly. He should have responded immediately. He should have fired these guys as soon as these allegations were made and found to be true.
And Charlie, I thought what Dave was saying was interesting when you, of course, mentioned the fact that this is what happens when you're in charge. If there's one thing that people, I think, around state government over the last many decades realize, and that is that Speaker Michael Madigan is a detail type of fellow. He is in charge. And it does become a problem when you have cases like this, because it's hard to say, I had any deniability in this because, you know, I've had this reputation for so long.
Yeah, and as I was saying, it to me, the very deliberate nature of his operations and his actions work against him in this regard. In retrospect, he should have fired these people immediately, but he didn't, because that's not his style. But on the other hand, he did act. He didn't try and cover it up. He didn't try and sweep it under the rug. He didn't try and shift these guys to some other position. He flat out fired them.
Go ahead, Brian.
And I was going to say, the behavior, the timing of the behavior came before the Harvey Weinstein incident that kind of prompted this national blow up and this reassessment of the way we as a society, and particularly men in positions of power, have behaved and handled these sorts of complaints. And Speaker Madigan is certainly not the only person to have perhaps not handled things in early 2017 and before the way we expect them to be handled, you know, in late 2017 and 2018 and going forward.
Let's turn our attention to another issue that has cropped up, certainly getting a lot of attention nationally and right here in Illinois as well. And that includes that involves Facebook. And Lisa Madigan, Speaker Madigan's daughter and the Illinois Attorney General, joining many other attorneys general around the country, wanting more information from Facebook over how personal information of users was made available to some companies without the user's consent. And Dave, what is going on here? What's this all about?
Well, it's a case where the attorney general says she's joining the other attorneys general in the nation. I think they're up to 37 or so in trying to get to the bottom of how the Analytica, the Cambridge Analytica, got so much information from Facebook users having clicked the terms of service or whatever that little fine print is that you're supposed to click. That's something that, you know, just like the cell phones, no one thought of 30 or 40 years ago, and now the law is rushing to catch up with it. And is there such a thing as privacy on the internet?
That would be my question. Is this just a lesson learned for everyone that when you put something on the internet or involve yourself in some way with an app that you can't be sure who's seeing it and how the information is going to be used?
I would say it's a reminder that you have no privacy. Whatever goes online is there. It'll be there until the sun goes nova. And the smart thing is not to put down anything that you would not want shouted from the rooftops.
And Lisa Madigan, I saw her interviewed on Chicago television station ABC. She made an interesting point that I think is also important for people to remember, that these are not just message boards the way they were in the early days of the internet. Facebook, Google, companies like that, these are big businesses. And we, the users of these services, are not, in fact, the customers. The customers are advertisers who are paying for our eyeballs. We are the product that they are selling, and they are taking our personal data and turning that into money. And, you know, they want as much of that data and to use it in as loose a way as they possibly can, you know, right up to the line where it would drive people to, you know, hashtag delete Facebook, as people have been saying this week. And we should also mention she's, you know, Lisa Madigan's, you know, is seeking more information and joining this action. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox has also sued Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. So this is, you know, an interesting case. And I'm waiting to see if there's any reaction in Illinois, in the Illinois legislature, about, you know, sort of doing any sort of advertising disclosure requirements. We've heard rumblings of this in the past, you know, to actually regulate the way, because this does come down to how, you know, is political advertising different than selling shoes? That's one of the big questions here.
Well, and I certainly got a lot of ads popping up on Facebook on my feed, I noticed, during the primary election and even for several months before that, especially from the two nominees for their parties, Pritzker and Rauner. So, yeah, somebody is able to use some type of analytics in there to figure out, you know, who's supposed to see these and who isn't.
They want to reach you, Sean. They want to know all about
you know, and if people have never played, I've actually done this. You can go in and see what Facebook thinks you are. There's, if you go through the settings, you can Google it. I think, you know, if you look for like a Facebook advertising profile or something like that, it'll show you how to get there. And, you know, they will have things like conservative politics, liberal politics, Second Amendment, you know, things like that, where they, you know, they kind of type categorize you, and then, you know, you can delete those things if you feel they don't reflect you. You can delete them all if you want to just kind of create chaos with their advertising system. But, you know, that this is interesting. Whether this actually works is another question. And I would, I listened to a really interesting episode of the public radio program On the Media, came out last weekend, where they kind of dove deep into this question of, does this advertising, does this stuff Cambridge Analytica is, you know, claims to be doing, does it actually work? And you know, the evidence seems to be not nearly as much as they say it does. So if people are interested in that, On the Media, it's good listening. I recommend it.
Well, also, well, in a sense, it's analogous to what happens on TV. If you watch ESPN or sports channels, you get one kind of advertising. If you watch kids shows, cartoon shows on Saturday morning, you get another kind of advertising. The intent of the advertisers is to try and reach an audience that would care about their products. And with the algorithms that Facebook and others use, they've taken it to a new level in being able to target, here's what Charlie Wheeler is interested in based on stuff he clicks on, things he's posted. So these are the advertisements, be they political or be they commercial, that we're going to make sure pop up on his webpage.
Last weekend, we had several marches take place around the country and here in Illinois regarding gun violence, people protesting that, calling for more gun control. And sure enough, a couple of days later, the House holds a hearing to talk about gun violence, and including discussing some legislation that has already been to the governor's desk. The governor vetoing this legislation would require state licensing of gun shops. Was this, Brian, just an opportunity to try to build some support for an override? Is that what this hearing was about?
It seems, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, this is something that came during a holiday week. The legislature's not even in session. You know, you plan these hearings for a city where the major media operations in the state are. But it was also an opportunity to hear from people who are activists and victims of gun violence who, you know, maybe for whatever reason, can't make the trip to Springfield. So, yeah, I mean, it certainly serves to elevate this issue and keep it in the news the week before this march. And, it has the benefit of making the politicians who are at the hearing appear to be, you know, responsive to this issue when it's coming to a sort of climax in public discourse because of these marches.
They want to make sure they want to make sure all the lawmakers know that it's OK to vote for the override.
And also this week, we had a somewhat conservative lawmaker, David McSweeney, representative out of Barrington. He introduced legislation that would allow police to get a warrant to take guns if a court decides that the owner is a danger to himself or others, or if they believe there's an immediate danger, they could take the weapons and justify the actions later in court. A little surprising to see this come from somebody like David McSweeney.
I mean, I'm not that surprised. I think, you know, Republicans have, in general, when they don't, you know, want to see regulation of gun ownership itself or of the types of firearms that people can own or putting conditions on ownership, then they say, well, you know, we need to focus on mental health and making sure that, we're not affecting law-abiding gun owners, but we're affecting, you know, the gun owners who should not have the guns. And his proposal to let police, you know, either be able to go to a judge and say, I need like a warrant to take somebody's guns away because we, you know that this person is, made threats or is in some way a danger to himself or others, then, you know, that's one thing. Or they can go at, like you said, Sean, they can sort of, if it's an imminent threat, they can take the weapons and then, you know, explain to the court afterwards why. This stands in contrast to a measure that has been advancing in the General Assembly that would let family members go to a judge and say, we would like the police and courts to step in. We think our relative is a danger. And, you know, we want law enforcement to come in and take weapons away from him. McSweeney says, no, this should be something that the police, who are more neutral arbiters, they should have that power, shouldn't be on family members.
But Dave, this seems like to me exactly what many gun owners say they're the most afraid of, that the government will come and take guns away.
I don't know if I'm oversimplifying it by saying it shows how a lot of the Second Amendment stuff is not a Republican-Democrat issue. It's a Chicago versus downstate issue. But in terms of why McSweeney believes he is the one who ought to be sponsoring this bill, really, I haven't asked him. Maybe we should.
Charlie, your thoughts on this piece, not just this piece of legislation, but just on this whole topic in general. Are we seeing some movement in the legislature?
Well, I think it's like Dave said, this is one of the very rare issues that doesn't break along partisan lines in the Illinois General Assembly, but rather is a matter of regional interest, where the folks in the Chicago area have a very different opinion of firearms than the folks, say, in southern Illinois. And I get the sense that the general attitude in the General Assembly is that we have to do more. We have to look at the mental health aspects of it. And perhaps one way is to authorize police, if they find that someone is a danger, to remove the weapons until that person can get mental health counseling or is deemed composed enough to have his weapons back. On the other hand, to outlaw certain types of devices, certain types of weaponry. I'm of the opinion, which probably will get me in trouble with Second Amendment folks, I don't see why deer hunters need a military-type assault weapon to go out and get a deer. And so there's a move to ban bump stocks, which is a device that turns otherwise regular weapons into army assault-type weapons, rapid-fire, almost like machine guns. There's talk about banning large-capacity magazines that would assist someone to shoot a number of bullets in a big hurry. Those kinds of ideas are being considered. There's also talk about having more intensive background checks. And I think it's a response to what happened in Florida. And I think the mood is that we have to do something about this. If for no other reason, our constituents are going to be up in arms. And the marches that we've seen, these young people, a lot of them are old enough to vote.
Well, just a few minutes left here. And Brian, I did want to mention again, we've now been over a week since the primary election. And on the Republican side, we've still not seen any really coming together of Jeannie Ives, who ran a very tight race against Governor Bruce Rauner. She's not come along and said basically that she's going to, you know, be a big supporter of Governor Rauner, but she did say she would vote for him but not campaign for him. This appears to be something that could linger all the way to the general election, this schism in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is going to be a challenge for Governor Rauner. I thought our public radio colleague Dave McKinney at our member station WBEZ had a very interesting story at the very end of last week. He had Representative Ives on the telephone and asked her who would be a better governor, Bruce Rauner or J.B. Pritzker. And just, you know, one of these great radio moments, he lets the silence play itself out.
About 40 seconds, I think it took her to answer that.
And she finally says, okay, I guess, you know, Rauner, but, you know, she'll vote for him. As you said, she'll vote for him, but she's not going to, you know, sort of be an active campaigner. There are some conservatives who, I think, as we mentioned last week, have gotten back on board with him. But there are still others who, you know, are using words like mendacious, which is, you know, a fancy way of saying that the governor's a liar in their view, you know, for his ads saying that, you know, Ives was House Speaker Madigan's favorite Republican, which, as we've said on this show before, if anyone knows her and knows of her very conservative positions, is not a true statement. But, you know, there are others who have gotten back on board, but it's going to be something that, you know, not only the governor needs to care about, not only for his reelection, but, you know, for what, you know, remains of his legislative agenda this year at what is either the, you know, midpoint or the end of his political career.
Well, I would suspect in a sense he's going to be less effective in the General Assembly. His ability to influence the Republican caucus is not going to be as strong. People who bucked him and voted for a budget and then to override his veto of the budget last summer, most of them, I think only one of them was defeated. And now a lot of them chose not to run, but they're still going to be in office until next January. So they'll be there. And I could foresee the governor almost becoming sort of irrelevant to the whole process on the budget, where the General Assembly, the two parties and both chambers will get together, come up with a spending plan, send it to the governor, and if he signs it, fine. If he vetoes it, we'll override him. I think the bigger danger for Republicans up and down the ticket is that folks who supported Ives, who look at, in Ives' term, as Rauner's being Benedict Rauner, they're not going to vote for J.B. Pritzker. They may just stay home, which means their votes won't be there for candidates, Republican candidates for Congress, for the General Assembly, for local offices, all up and down the ticket. That's the real danger, I think, for Republicans.
Dave, you've covered the governor since the election. Any indication from him on how he's going to bridge this divide that's out there?
You know, he says he's going to do it, but getting along with the General Assembly and compromising on things hasn't been part of his brand, particularly the House Democrats. So it's hard to see where the governor is going to say, let bygones be bygones, and someone like Representative Ives will say, oh, yeah, count me in. And when, Charlie, you were talking about, you know, just jamming a budget into the governor's office and overriding the veto, that sounds like something they could do at the end of April, not the end of May. Maybe they could just declare victory and get out. On to November.
And Brian, I just wanted to touch base since we have about 30 seconds or so. When it comes to a state budget, we, of course, this is about that time of the year where you start to see negotiations pick up. We haven't heard anything at this point.
No, I mean, we're still in the midst of the appropriations process where, you know, the various agency heads, Supreme Court, Chief Justice, people like that come and testify before the legislature. So we have been having those hearings. I think we're going to continue to have those. We've had revenue forecasts where the budget gurus of the governor's office and the state's, you know, legislative commission on fiscal matters comes and testifies. So we are still in the midst of that process, but I think Dave is perhaps being overly optimistic when he suggests that we might get this in April. I've only seen a budget that early once in my decade plus here, and that was when they had some renovations to do in the building. So maybe if we can convince them that there are some needed renovations in the Capitol, we could get them moving, but I'm not holding my breath.
All right, time for our notes from the field. Dave, let's start with you.
Will grandfather Hood change Bruce Rauner? We'll find out soon enough as the governor revealed this week that he and the first lady are going to be first-time grandparents by mid-April.
All right. And Charlie, let's go to you.
Well, there's a report out from a Washington, D.C.-based organization analyzing the state's transportation network. And their conclusion was that more than a third of the major local and state urban roads are in poor or mediocre condition. 9% of the local and state maintained bridges are structurally deficient, and it costs Illinois motorists in the neighborhood of $16.4 billion a year in terms of extra vehicle operating costs because of driving on roads in need of repair, lost time and fuel because of congestion, and the cost of traffic accidents caused by these inferior roads.
All right. And Brian?
Yeah, there's yet another addition to the Chicago mayor's race this week. A couple, actually, but one of the interesting big ones is former Chicago Public Schools CEO Paul Vallis is his attorney, at least, says that he's going to be creating a Paul Vallis for Chicago campaign fund, and says Vallis is, quote, 150% committed to running. That's what he told the Tribune. That raises some interesting questions about his attorney's math abilities, especially for somebody who is the school CEO. But, you know, this could be a really interesting mayoral race looking ahead towards next year in Chicago.
That will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Dave Dahl. You can get a podcast of the show at nprillinois.org, and production assistance provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.